start afternoon session. Are you ready? Okay. Okay, I would like to hand over to Richard.
Good afternoon, everybody. My job is to say a few words and then hand over to Samantha. I will say a very few words and then do just that. As you know, the trustees commissioned a survey of our reputation earlier this year. Many of you would have been involved with that, and thank you for the help that you've given us with it. We published that survey in June. The trustees have asked us to publish it to seek the views of all of the advisory groups that we're involved with, which is of course why we're here, and to come up with some proposals for actions that could be taken, which will be considered by the trustees at their meeting in November. Then they asked us to commission, or they agreed that they would commission, another survey probably in around 2020. And the purpose of this is that the survey will inform our key performance indicators on the qualitative elements of our strategic goals. The quantitative elements are easy. It's easy for us to say how many countries are using the standards, how many standards we've written. It's much more difficult to get KPIs for those qualitative issues. And so we'll be able to look at the results of this survey and then another one in 2020 and see what has changed. I'm responsible for this, but Samantha's done all of the heavy lifting, so I'll hand over to her now to take you through the slides and the questions that we'll be grateful for your views.
Thanks, Richard. So if I can draw your attention to Agenda Paper 3, which is the slide deck, which I'm assuming that you've all seen in advance, so I'm not going to spend too much time over it or speak to every single slide. I think Richard's already pretty much given you the overview of the context, which was slide 4. I'll just mention a little bit about the methodology. So it was a mixture of telephone interviews and online surveys, and you will have all been invited to take part in the online survey. So for those of you who filled it in, we'd like to take the opportunity to say thank you very much. It is completely confidential, so we don't know which of you filled it in or what you said, so no panic there, but thank you for that. On the methodology point, it's not something we want to talk about today, but I'd be really interested to know if you have any feedback that you wanted to give offline about what the process was like for you to fill it in, whether it was onerous, whether it made sense, whether the questions flowed, all that kind of stuff. So if you do have any comments about that, please do feel free to drop me an email, and I'd be happy to talk about that offline. We're not going to discuss that today. Richard's mentioned a little bit about the timeline, which is what we have on slide 6. So at the moment, we're in the July to October phase, which is where we're really trying to digest the results of the survey, see where we've got positives that we need to continue doing, and see where there might be anything that we want to take additional actions. And we have a couple of ways of looking at that. So we have an internal focus group at the moment, which have been meeting to discuss these things, but we're also going around to all our advisory groups, including obviously GPF, to see what your input can be and see what ideas you've got that we can then formulate into some recommendations, which we will take to the trustees in November. And those will go into next year's work plan. So there'll be key things that we can look at, and then we can measure progress against. As Richard said, 2020 will probably repeat this, and we can measure if we've progressed in those areas. So slides 8 to 12 are the summary of the findings. The overall findings were really positive. So the main message that we got out of the research was continue the good work, and we were really pleased with that. I think it's really important that we don't focus on negatives. We're looking at areas where we can continue to improve, but this is definitely evolution, not revolution, we think. There's quite a lot of positives in there, and we want to be happy about those. The results were particularly encouraging considering our size. We're a small organisation, and particularly pleasing was that they were consistent with feedback we've received through other channels. So this gave people an opportunity to speak quite candidly, anonymously, and actually what we heard wasn't that different from what we've heard through our formal channels. So again, that was quite a pleasing result for us. So 9 to 12, I won't go through in any detail. They basically go through the key areas that we have findings. So drivers of reputation, where we were highly rated for transparency, independence, leadership. The slight area of weakness there was timeliness and the perception that we're not particularly timely in some areas. On consultations, again, we were perceived as open and effective. The main issue there was whether we achieved the right stakeholder balance. So there was some querying, especially from emerging markets. There's some issues perhaps that the further away you are geographically from us, that the less engaged you feel. Interestingly, on engagement, which is slide 11, the least positive group about effective relationship management was preparers. So that's a key thing maybe for you to take note of. So 84% of advisory group members in general felt we were effective at relationship management, which is a great score. But amongst preparers, it was 67%. So there's a bit of a difference there. But the consensus was that we listen and we take viewpoints into account, and there was a clear appetite for more opportunities to engage with us, and that's a positive thing. And slide 12 just mentions about the public interest mission, and again, a really positive result for us on people agreeing that we do meet our public interest mission. So following this, Ubiquity made some recommendations to us, and those are laid out on slide 14. Top one again being continue the good work, which we're really pleased with, but their main key areas that they highlighted were improving outreach and consulting more widely, improving timeliness, responding to the need for simple, practical and workable standards, and interestingly harnessing advocates to act as ambassadors, which was one of the areas they picked up on because of our high levels of advocacy.
One quick question for you, if you don't mind. In those recommendations, I don't see anything on the meaningfulness or understanding or the understandability of financial information. Were they part of the questions? Because I sort of get the overall objective, but if you actually ask readers and preparers, are the statements more meaningful and understandable than they were before, is that not one of the measures that we need to include as well, and was that part of the discussion at all?
There was a question in there about whether we meet our objective, which was to, I can't quote off the top of my head, but it's about making financial statements that are useful and globally comparable. I can't think of the exact wording off the top of my head. And there were, we didn't ask people whether
and maybe when we get to the recommendations, the one thing that stands out to me was to be meaningful and understandable. And I think whether it be, you know, why your preparer rating's lower, why you've got a bit of a there, I'm not sure, but I just keep that in mind. To me, that would be a very strong measure for the effectiveness of the the organization would be, are the statements more meaningful, understandable, and comparable? You could go comparable, but pick the not just comparable or in compliance with something doesn't necessarily mean people understand them, use them, and think they're effective.
Yeah, I think that probably comes into the simple, practical, and workable standards. Yeah, I take your point on that. So if we move to slide 16, slide 16 highlights what we think we need to do in response to this feedback and what we've heard. So as I said, these findings are consistent with things that we've heard through other channels, so we do already have some actions underway in most of these areas. That's not to say it's done and dusted, this feedback isn't valid, it's just to say that we're aware of these issues and we have started working on them. So slides 17 to 21 lay out some of the areas where we have taken some actions already, and we feel that by the time we repeat this in 2020, hopefully some of those positives will have filtered through into people's perceptions. For the rest of the feedback, we would like to seek your help in where we need to develop more in these areas. So where we're not already taking action, what more could we do? So if we come to slide 23, these are the key questions which we'd like to discuss today. So we have three questions for the GPF. And I'd like to, if we could perhaps take these one by one and spend equal amounts of time on each of them. So the first question is that Ubiquity recommended we engage more with stakeholders, and they especially highlighted emerging markets, users, and smaller businesses from the feedback that they'd heard. So we'd be interested to know from you, considering the developments we've already made, which are on slides 17 to 21, how else can the Foundation improve its engagement with its stakeholders, and what does great engagement look like for you as preparers?
Preparer gave us a lowest score, so I really welcome your comment on how we can improve. Sandra.
I think...
please.
Maybe just reaching out, and back to the first comment on simplification, understandability. I think even our conversation earlier, I think there's a bias to call it the analyst or what the definition of a user is. when it comes to some of the disclosures. And, you know, when you're talking about the premium earlier on disclosing the premium, realistically, if it goes through some of those assumptions, that no user could actually take that effectively for any of us and say, I could do a better job than your auditors can, than you can, than management can. And I think we're just making sure that there's a question that comes with some of the disclosures that says, what is it really for? And how can we, back to that simplification side, of get information that says it's good to know by users, but what do they do with it? Do they actually use it? And is it a nice to know versus a must know? And as we get into simplification, take the approach of, is it clear? Is it understandable? What's really driving the usefulness of the financial statements? And, you know, there's, you know, when we ask our shareholders, our investors, you know, of our 40 pages of financial statements, what do they find useful? They always come back with maybe a third of it, maybe, you know, a third of it to 40% of it. Like, there's still so much in there that is required that they just say, look, it's nice to know, but realistically, I'm never going to use it for valuing your company. Like, how do we balance that simplicity off of that side of it? So that kind of engagement of learning where the nice-to-knows are or the nice-to-haves versus real value drivers on disclosure items, I think would be one area that would, as you engage, try and focus a little bit more on the meaningfulness, focus more on usefulness, focus more on what are you going to use it for? How are you going to take that to do your assessment of of this company? And if you put the lens from that perspective on it, you know, we may actually be able to simplify and take that feedback faster.
Sandra?
I was going to echo or say a lot of the things that were just said, in particular on disclosures and ensuring that there's more questions asked to really understand if it is information that's going to be useful to an investor or user versus something that's just nice to know. But when I look at this, I do think that sometimes standards are written too academically or they're made too complex, even not just the language, but the provisions within the standards. And I think if you did more outreach to some of the groups that may not have as sophisticated of a policy or financial reporting group, do they understand them? Can they take the words that are written down and be able to implement them in their companies? I think a lot of the people, at least on the preparer side, that you are talking to are bigger companies in general, where they have people that have been in the arena of interpreting and applying the standards. So just a thought.
That's helpful, but both comments are very helpful. But the question for me then is, how do we get to those people that can give us the answers? And I think that's what the survey has thrown up, that certain people just don't feel that we're engaging with them. So they most may well be the right questions, but how do we make sure that people are actually hearing them and answering them? Yeah. Using that video.
Stephen.
Sandra just said a lot of stuff I was going to say. When reaching out to emerging markets, smaller businesses, and for smaller businesses, there probably are ways of getting to them. Just, you know, look further down the capitalization chart. I guess emerging markets might be more difficult to find the right companies. But certainly the complexity of accounting standards is a barrier. The ones that we've seen issued recently, the big three, excluding insurance for the niche market, but you know they are complex to understand, to apply, and the smaller companies, the emerging markets, just haven't got the depth of technical accounting expertise to really engage fully with you on this, I think.
Chris,
have we thought maybe of expanding, you know, once a year, this group to say you're going to have select emerging market or small businesses invited for one meeting a year and have a special topic or deep dive with them on effectiveness and some of the items you want to cover specifically with them on to the extent you want people who are engaged, right? And you want people who will give you those constructive and honest feedback. And so maybe trying to find, you know, more prominent, preparers and users in that market and you know, try to expand for one session a year, even just having a workshop to get to them.
Would cost be a drawback? I think it's easier for large corporations to fund the travel, and perhaps when you're going out and doing educational sessions, it may be an opportunity to reach out to market participants in that region to get some feedback.
Chris?
Maybe a little bit along the lines of what Sandra said. I think it comes down to the saying, if the mountain doesn't come to Mohammed, Mohammed got to go to the mountain. They won't come to you, you've got to go to them. Mm-hmm. And if I look back, the strongest positive feedback I heard from emerging markets was when members of the staff and the board traveled down there and sat down with people to listen to their concerns. And that needs to, it's certainly more burdensome than waiting for comment letters, but I think that is the best way to go. I think overall, I think there are two levels to it. The one is a level of engagement, and the second one is the transparency of the engagement. So I think you do, there are a lot of good things you do, but I don't think they get transparent enough. And I think a lot of the response, I mean, it's perception that the responses you got. So I think you got to work on both the underlying and the perception. So I think there is work to do on the marketing front. And if I think about emerging markets, I know that, I don't know if it's still the case today, but when I was member of the advisory council, there were emerging markets breakfasts. I don't know whether anyone outside the council knew about them. But that's one example of things you do. The second one, and that may sound now selfish on behalf of this group, you don't promote this group very well. I don't know how many stakeholders of IFRS know that there is a global preparers group. And that's why I think, and that goes beyond that question number one, I think to provide more transparency in the good stuff we have will help, because it is perception. It's the same thing with number three, the timeliness. I understand that people say, well, can't be. The end of the comment period on an exposure draft is in the 30th of June 2017, and then it says, well, the standard will come fourth quarter 2018. Can't take that long. Yeah. And one element of the thought is because they don't know about the work that is going on between the two dates. If they had the transparency into what are the efforts that things go through, they may develop a better understanding and more sympathy with the timelines. So I think for all of the points, for all three questions, don't only look at what do we have to change in process and other things, but at the same time, look at the marketing side of the house.
We will be going to the advisory council and the breakfast on the 17th and 18th. Your points are on there.
Okay, Barendra, please.
Yeah, I will echo what Christophe said, that this organization has been doing fantastic job, no doubt about it. But what perhaps where it lacks is communication and communication. And the two findings, what I see is that stakeholders in Asia, Oceania, and Africa most likely to disagree with the balance of stakeholders. Some perception that emerging markets and users may be underrepresented in the consultations. If you look at the responses we have for the EDs or DPs, you will find that there is hardly any response coming from this area. Now, on one hand, we can't complain that, we are not consulted. On the other hand, we can't afford to remain outside this process of response.
what is actually happening. I myself coming from emerging markets, so I can share this with you. But I have personally, I have this issue with my own Institute of Chartered Accountants of India. Well, first of all, as Christoph, you rightly said, that they don't even know that there is a GPF. They don't even know there is an advisory committee. They don't know that if there is an issue which is bothering them, they have got multiple channels to ventilate their issues through the country's representative. I'm here representing my country. So they don't know. I mean, they have their own communication. In our case, the institute I'm talking about is earlier they were not responding to EDs, and nowadays they have started responding to EDs. That's it. There is nothing, it doesn't go beyond that. So therefore, a lot of these responses are coming, arising out of perception, perceptional issues. Look at the carve-outs they have in the system. The IND AS is not adoption, but it is convergence. Now, if you look at the carve-outs, you will see that a lot of carve-outs are perceptional issues. I mean, there has to be some communication system from IASB. Logically speaking, the other party should have come to IASB. Now, I mean, it, as a big brother, it's the responsibility, it has now become the responsibility of IASB to go and tell them that, look, this is, if this, you have this issue, then we already considered this kind of positioning, and we have had a global discussion, and we have multiple kinds of issues are coming on the table for our discussion, and this is how we have come to this conclusion. I think they will become a part of the global deliberation and the standard framing process. So what is happening today is that emerging market is not truly speaking a true participant in the global standard setting process. So that is why I'm saying that if you go through this entire survey, you know, my summary is that if at all, I'm now that I'm seeing IASB from a close distance, I can realize that it is a fantastic organization. But possibly it's like, I'll give an example. It is not that IASB is not touring India. They had in the last 3 years, they have several times they have gone ahead and toured India. I know that they had had discussion with multiple people. But then the representative of GPF or the advisory committee was not consulted. They were not taken on board. So they go to somebody, and then they have some discussion, and there is no follow-up thereafter. So therefore, it is not possible for IASB to go ahead and discuss and then continue to follow up. Not possible. They have to get it done by some hierarchy. I mean, some system has to be there for follow up.
I think that's a really good example. Yeah. The trustees met in New Delhi, held a meeting in New Delhi in October last year, so just barely a year ago. And everything that you've said, I recognize. And the concern I have is that isn't more widely known, that the trustees actually had a full trustee meeting for 3 days in Delhi a year ago. And that's the sort of thing that we need to get much better at promulgating and making people understand.
Yeah, but then we have to think of establishing some kind of, there has to be somebody representing IASB in each country. How will that happen and all that? So the one maybe if from all countries GPF members are not coming or advisory committee members are not coming, then I think can we spot the big corporations in each of these countries, and can we have a line of communication with them? There has to be some line of communication created. So they're for a long time they were detached from the first world countries. So now that has to be done.
Thank you. So, Luis.
We were discussing a little earlier about the materials that the ISB make available. And the Green Book was presented. I asked whether the come in Portuguese. I was trying to be funny, but there was a purpose, because when it comes to emerging markets, the language it's a big barrier to get people to really understand what IFRS are. Unfortunately, would be great if everybody could speak English, and not only English in general, but a very specific type of English that people need to understand. And that is a natural barrier. So I don't know how that could be overcome, but it exists. Costs. I complained about the fact that it's expensive, and then I learned that there are some specific prices for specific types of groups. I didn't know that. So maybe communication, sure, is really important, and advertising these things and making them available to the public in emerging economies is critical. And being there, because I don't know if I don't think that if the physical distance is also a problem. I mean if people is not going to these countries, they don't get to feel the culture that exists around the IFRS. And there is a culture, it's unavoidable. The other thing is complexity. It's really complex. You need to be a specialist to work with IFRS today. So I don't know, in the long term, if it's possible to set some goals of making things more simple, but it's really complicated. If you see, for instance, I don't want to pick on specific standards or so, but for instance, IFRS 9 is really complicated, even for a big company, a big industrial company, not a bank, to implement some of the requirements that are there. So I imagine for a small company with people not speaking English, with little resources, it's virtually impossible. It's really difficult. So these are some of the remarks.
Srinath?
Yep. I think I add to what other people are saying about IASB taking a lead in engaging with the audience, which is both preparers and users. I can take a parallel with the big four audit firms. They have this annual exercise of having this client engagement service to find out where they lack in terms of service. So I would say that similarly, IASB should also have annual surveys conducted in terms of feedback from preparers and users, what they feel. I know that this exercise has been done with 50 people contributing to that. You can have a much wider audience to find out where exactly we are lacking. In addition to that, simplifying is, I think, one of the main criteria for engaging preparers, especially making the financial statements more understandable. I know that there are projects like disclosure project, wherein there are a lot of efforts being made to simplify and putting related information in one place, etc. But I don't know how far that has been communicated to the audience. That is one thing. And it is perceived that the standards are more of a compliance exercise rather than useful exercise from the preparers. So they tend to follow the standards just as a compliance rather than utility in that. Again, I can also see that in the next topic we are discussing, we are saying that the financial statements are materially misstated if the information is obscured. So just correlate that. How can you make sure that the information is obscure or not obscure if it is not easy to understand? So these type of things, we can only get the feedback from the end user. So it's better to have some sort of annual mechanism of getting a survey circulated and getting their feedback and taking some action. I know that there are a lot of advisory bodies providing that feedback, but it is better directly to engage with the end users.
My slight concern with that is that, as you know, things move slowly. If we do an annual survey, then there is that risk that people will say, well, nothing's changed since the last survey. Mm. And that is because it takes time for things to filter through. I mean, do you think that that risk is still worth it? Does the cost justify the benefits? Would we be better off doing slightly less frequent surveys, or do you think annually is the right answer?
The reason I mentioned annually, because we are talking about a lack of timeliness, which has been pointed out in this survey. So maybe we can consider once in 3 years, etc.
Okay, that's helpful to know. It's just useful to get
that. Frankly, I have to admit, I think the next one is planned for 2020. I think that's too early.
Too early?
Yeah, because you won't be starting efforts under your plan before 2018. Yeah. So that means either these are efforts who work and make people understand that things are different very, very quickly, but usually until things are established and until people see that they are established and until they acknowledge that they've seen that, that takes some time. So I think 2020 is too early for the next one.
I plan
because I don't think you will see very significantly different results because it is too early to see the impact of any changes you make.
I plan to retire in 2021. So we can kick that onto my successor.
That will be the Olympic thought every 4 years.
Okay, you are keep please.
Yes, I think the organization should pay more attention on the public relations aspect so that, you know, general public awareness in each country can be more increased. Mm. It can create good atmosphere for, you know, all those communication aspects by IFRS. One of the good things described in the page 20, looks like you have strengths in your editorial function capability, right? To focus on plain English structure readability. I don't see clear improvement so far yet, but I hope it is increasingly, you know, improving from now on, right? So what kind of editorial function enhancement has been done? You hired some editorial expert or something?
We recently strengthened the function internally, so I think it will take a little bit of time for those benefits to filter through. We're already getting positive feedback from the board members about the board papers being clearer. Whether that's actually filtering through into published documents yet, it's probably going to take a little bit of time, but I think our board papers have a certain level of clarity that they perhaps didn't have before.
Good move.
Sandra?
Okay. I'm probably one of the GPF members that has been on the advisory group for the longest. And when I look back over time, there were periods of time where I wasn't sure if our concerns were being addressed or embraced by the board. And you certainly have seen the evolution, and you see good response now. And I think that will create more people being involved in the process. People aren't going to be involved and provide feedback unless they feel that their views are being heard and responded to. So, you know, even mentions and documents, you know, the GPF group did this, and you see now we actually have a backlog of people that would like to be on the GPF. So they go hand in hand.
Do you have
okay.
Further questions?
Yeah. So Ubiquity recommended that we harness advocates to act as ambassadors, and I think this moves into what we've just been discussing, which is that perhaps there's a lot of good work we're doing that isn't getting out there, and part of that may be that we're quite a small organisation with limited resources. And they identified that most of the people they asked said they would definitely speak highly of us, they would recommend us. Is there a way we could be using that better, to better effect? And specifically, is there a way we could be using groups such as the Global Preparers Forum as ambassadors, and how do you guys see your role in that area? Is there something you think you could be doing in that space?
Yeah, Colin, please.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I think the ISB have been great in recent time of getting out parts of the world and seeing different countries and visiting different organisations, including the big four accounting firms and the regulatory bodies, etc. I think it's a real opportunity to use for each of those countries, their GPF representatives for that country, to partner up through those tools. And I I think Hans, I don't know if anyone here is down in Australia next week, but I was aware of that through being invited to a flurry of Big Four accounting firms and other bodies around the country. And being on the corporate side, I think just brings a lot more transparency and credibility in what the ISB is trying to achieve if they had support of a GPF member along the way to sort of partner up on a roadshow, per se, when those things are happening. Because to be honest, on a day-to-day basis, we, all our representatives here, pretty much know every country managing partner of all the Big Four and all the major firms around there on different bodies we may sit on. So I think that could go a long way. And also just to get out what the GPF actually does and squash this perception that, you know, things are getting done and there is representation and the voice is being heard.
Okay, Steve.
I guess I'd like to throw the question back a little bit and say, well, you know, do you see us as ambassadors? How would you see that looking? Because from my perspective, coming on to these meetings, and the agenda is purposely to help the ISB with their projects coming up. It's not to help us with the challenges we have on a day-by-day basis.
Good point.
And it's particularly focused, and it is... while we appreciate that you do listen to our views and feedback on the views, and you've done a lot of work around that, it is more one way than two way. So therefore, if you want to take this recommendation on board, how do you see that working? How do you see the give and the takes working to everyone's advantage?
Yeah, it's a challenge.
I can offer you my view on that. As a former member of the Advisory Council, when I was on the Advisory Council, I took the view that my job was to provide advice, and that when I was away from the Council, it was my job to provide clarity, to a clear message of what was happening at the Foundation. But I wasn't employed by the Financial Services Authority to act as an ambassador for the IFRS Foundation. And if I'd been asked to do that, that would have been challenging. And so I think there is, personally, I think there's a trade-off. I think we gain most from you being candid with us. And that's very important. And it's really helpful if you go out to the world and say that that's the role you play, and if it's a good relationship, that you say so. Personally, I think it's more difficult for you to go out and say, this standard's brilliant. I know because I'm on the GPS. But that's a personal view. I'm just putting that in order to prompt us that.
But we're interested.
This is an important question.
When we were both on the council, did we have a similar discussion back then on the
Very
role
probably.
Of the council of the
yes,
council
certainly.
Members and
yeah.
whether that goes into a kind of ambassador yeah. role? I remember that. I think there was even a discussion around the constitution of the council,
yeah.
Whether how the role of the council yeah. members is described. And it was obviously more an issue for those like you who were rather not on the clear preparer user side, but on some of the other more difficult stakeholder groups.
Yeah.
But I think back then it was obvious that council members were very open.
Yes.
And some people said, well, they wouldn't be here if they didn't felt like ambassadors with a positive attitude towards IFRS. The question is, what does the foundation make out of this? Where does it use the opportunity of having people locally who, even if not declared officially an ambassador, mm-hmm. who have a positive attitude, otherwise they wouldn't get engaged? Yeah. So how do they use it? And I think, for instance, on conferences, yeah, a lot of company representatives, other representatives, it doesn't appear to be, well, let's first pick them from the advisory bodies in a way of to have faces that people recognize, that they can say a few words about their advisory role. It's usually picking them from wherever. So I think there could be the existence of the members of the advisory bodies could be leveraged better. But I'm with Stephen, that's more a pull than a push, really.
Can I add to what Richard said? Because I think the GPF is in a slightly different position from the Advisory Council, in fact, because it's even more independent of us than the Advisory Council is. Because the Advisory Council is one of our bodies. It's part of our internal structure, although it's outside of her members. But you aren't actually even part of our structure at all. You're an entirely independent body. And personally, I think it's right it should stay that way, because I think if you were an internal body, you wouldn't be able to give us that kind of internal advice. So I don't think you can act, I don't think it would be appropriate for us to expect you to act as ambassadors or having a role as ambassadors. I think we can expect you to sort of engage with us constructively and pass back information about what's going on and help us sort of get the message across, but without saying you necessarily, you know, agree or disagree with IFRSX. I think that's a totally different issue. I thought Brindal made a very good point there about making sure that we liaise enough with GPF members. So if somebody's visiting, we should make sure that you're one of the first people we think about telling that we're coming and making sure you can be involved in that process. I think how you raise the profile of GPF is an interesting idea, because again, it's a bit strange because you're not an organisation that's got its kind of separate presence. I mean, we host you on our website in effect, but you're a body that only exists really for interacting with us. And how that profile is best raised, I mean in a sense we shouldn't probably try and raise the profile very directly ourselves, because again I think that kind of goes counter to the idea of you being an independent body. But you're all volunteers as well. I mean, there's a limit to how much you can, how best you can promote what you do externally.
I think you're touching the tension between the two elements. I guess I'll share the view that has already been shared, that actually a little bit of inviting us to the platform as well would help us to be more ambassadorial, even if we are not ambassadors. Yeah. And I agree that I'm not sure it's what we would look to be doing, really. But clearly we value the process, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So we're already engaged to that level. So part of the raising a profile of the GPF, which would again kind of help us to feel more towards that role, and also capturing us as individuals just representing the GPF, then sharing the platform a little bit might be quite helpful.
Yeah, and I think it's important to us that it's not just that you're kind of 15 individuals who provide a good individual contribution, but it's also important there's a whole range of formal and informal networks behind you as well that are supplying the input. So it's good to get your input as individuals, but we're looking for more than that as well.
But Peter, I admit I don't share that concern that if the foundation promotes it, that this could a call question about our independence, because I think what you should promote is your interaction with us.
Yes.
And that's why I tell you, we don't want to be promoted as a body. Hey, what a great body. That's not the idea. We know that we are. It's more really about engaging, that you're doing this. And I think a lot of people don't know it. They don't know of the existence. If they don't know of the existence of the body, they don't know about your interaction with it. And that's something you can promote, because it's part of your outreach and makes people understand how serious you are about it.
Have you also thought, is there an opportunity where you need examples of quote-unquote good disclosure? And I would assume the people as part of this committee are leading in disclosure opportunities where not only would you be able to promote per se or even use our disclosure examples of here's what good disclosure for this topic may be, and by the way, they're a member of our advisory committee, like link back to, in essence, one of the reasons why we're here as well, is we are leading in disclosure in certain areas, and we want to help and we want to participate, and maybe then build off of that as well, that, you know, there's an output out there called our financial statements that should be better than average, and is there a way to leverage that as examples and items that as you're going forward on types of disclosure if you need them?
It's incredibly difficult to do that, I think, because you just hold yourself as a hostage to fortune whenever you put something up as an example. You know, almost inevitably what will happen is put an example up and the company will go bust within the company.
I hear you, but everyone else is doing it. So the CA firms are doing it. Now, you know, the universities are doing it. We're getting requests all the time. Can we use your note in our education? Can we use your note in this? So the only ones who we aren't using it are ourselves. So anyway, it's just a thought. It's not like so be it, but everyone else is doing it. And if you want to raise the profile of this group, maybe there is a linkage there somehow to help the advocates even further. Look, we're part of it. We're also leading in disclosure, and here's just an example. You don't have to say it's the best. It's an example. But anyway, it's just a thought on how linking back to us as role models and helping the advocates for the greater.
Serena?
Yeah.
All of us know that complexity is one of the major concerns by the preparers, users, etc. And I would like to know what exactly we are doing from IASB point of view to simplify things. It came to my mind that you have something like transition resource group when the new standards come up. Maybe there should be an ongoing resource group for simplifying wherever there are opportunities. So it can be a focused group which only looks at the existing standards and see only one point agenda in that committee or in that group to simplify the existing pronouncements. So they should focus only on simplifying, and they should work towards that objective, and maybe that group can work with other advisory bodies. Like one of them is the GPF. They can work with GPF and get the information, feedback, and then work towards that. What do you think?
So it's what you are saying is different from Better Communication Initiative. We have Better Communication Initiative to make more understandable the standard.
Mm-hmm.
Not only standard, but also the financial statement as well. But your point is to make the standard itself more simplified.
Yes. I know that the disclosure project is one of that, but it should be on an ongoing basis, okay. Not one-time exercise.
I was thinking that we'll be ambassador if you want us to be ambassador. You have to make us ambassador, then we'll become ambassador. I'll share my experience when, in my limited capacity, I formed a group within the company, and then I got in touch with several other companies, and then I am now involving through a trade body, which is one of the best trade bodies in India. Through the trade body, I'm trying to get in touch with large number of big corporations. And every time I get an issue with GPF, I try to share what has been discussed, and I try to understand that on the upcoming issues, what are their minds, so that I can come here and represent not only by my personal points, but then collective points. So the point is that when IASB officials, when they go to a country, they invariably meet the standard setters. Now, the standard setting body in most countries is set up by a process of election. Mm. And that election process is political.
Mm.
And it is very difficult for any one of us here to crack that political body. Therefore, when the IASB officials, you are touring a country and having a meeting with the standard setters, I mean, try to indicate that you are really treating us as an ambassador so that we can interact and we can do the follow-up action on your behalf. And we can interact. The best process to bring those standard setters online is to make them involved in the process of deliberation. Throw issues at them and let them slowly over a period of time, let them develop this feeling that yes, what I feel is being represented in the global body. So that's the process, and that's where we can play a big role as an ambassador.
Sandra.
I just wanted to go back to the recommendation that you have a group to look at simplifying the standards. I think during the standard setting process, typically it starts off very theoretical or academic and approaches to how to do the accounting. And I think that there needs to be a step in the process that goes through and looks at where are all the areas that maybe theoretically it may be more pure, but how can we make it simpler to apply and not only think about it from the perspective of large companies, but think about it and organizations that don't have a very technical group and go through and figure out how can I make it simple, but tending more towards the theoretical approach versus being exactly 100% theoretically pure.
Can I just comment on that point, actually, because I think one of the difficulties the board sometimes faces is how best to do that in a way that's not going to introduce more complexity. So if you take something like the debate in leases on small value leases, and there are different ways you can go about dealing with that problem. So you could say that ideally the best information you get would be by capitalising all leases, but you don't want people to go overboard and do that when it's not going to make much difference. So one way you can deal with that is set up the overall principle and then rely on materiality for the cases where it's not going to make much difference. Another way you can do it is to set up some criteria for things that you will assume aren't going to be material and try and avoid people having to think about it in the cases where you don't think it's necessary for them to think about it. So you get a kind of trade-off there between a standard that could be written very simply in a way that you might say is just theoretical, or you could try and build in some things that are intended to simplify the accounting in some cases, but end up with a standard that looks really complex because you're trying to set up the thought process. And there are different ways of thinking about that. And I think getting to the heart of what people mean by simplicity versus complexity might be quite important as well. So it could be, are the resulting financial statements simple to understand or not? Is it the standard is easy to understand or not? And sometimes those things lead in different directions. And also, of course, you have to build into that as well that sometimes if you simplify too much, you lose useful information. So, for example, cash accounting is easy to understand, but it doesn't give you that much information about anything other than the cash movements.
In response, I have 2 points. One is that when we get the standards in multinational companies, we have to think about how are we going to boil this down so we can explain it to an accountant in the country that English is not their first language. They may not have a bachelor's degree, they may only have an associate's degree or practical experience. How do I boil it down so they can understand it and effectively implement our intent on how we want to implement the standard? So we're already having to go through and try to get the complexity out while we're doing our communication process. And then secondly, there are areas, if you look at the impairment standard, where you have two methods of having to calculate your impairment, although theoretically there are bases for doing that, I think it adds to complexity and it's one of the areas that if you sat back and thought what's really important is that the asset gets written down, what's the most simple way that we can achieve that instead of coming up with two methodologies?
Yeah. Mario.
I was thinking when hearing this last discussion about complexity, whether it's not somehow connected to the interaction that the ISB has with smaller investors, because from the experience I've accumulated, participate in the meetings with the CIMAC, they are highly qualified analysts, and I don't know if the common investor really has so refined and so complex needs of information, I don't know if by broadening the and reaching more investors maybe the ISB could maybe conclude that the need of complex information is not so high. So maybe it could make things more simple by changing the groups of stakeholders that are being consulted.
Just to give an example, when you implement IFRS 9 for a non-banking industry, so it should be a very simple approach. It cannot, you cannot go through the same steps what a bank follows for doubtful debt provisioning for a trading company, so where it is very straightforward business and they have few customers. Why should that preparer go through the same difficulties of or the wrong process of the provisioning methodology, what is suggested by the standard? So this is one area I can think of where the group can work on simplifying. So I know that the standard is communicated for all the industries across the globe, but having said that, that creates some complexity because everybody has to go through the same process.
Although I think we have to acknowledge that IFRS 9
yes.
has the simplification for trade receivables, which is just supposed to address a reduction in complexity. So.
Did the movement away from industry-specific guidance drive some of the complexity that we've seen in some of the standards? Have you all sat down and thought about that? And should there be some guidance that does have industry-specific approach?
So you think industry-specific approach would better address the complex issue?
If you looked at IFRS 9, it probably could have been easier to have it split up.
So I think the industry-specific approach may have two tails, two sides, because if we make it so we have to define what the industry is all about and which industry you are going to be following. And from the investor's side, it might be difficult to compare different industries. Having said that, just simple one standard could create, you know, extra complexity to some industry which are a little bit irrelevant. So yeah, that's a difficult area. But we are thinking about a kind of industry-specific presentation for primary financial statement. We haven't made a conclusion yet, but there might be a possibility we would provide some template of performance reporting industry basis. Sorry.
Maybe a comment. I think try to do something on an industry will be super difficult, specifically if you have companies which may think they belong to two or three industries, and then they end up, what should I take now, right?
If you only look at the industry grouping we have internally for our group, that shows you how difficult it is to assign companies to industries.
So I think actually it is difficult to write a standard towards different industries. I think the other thing is, which I started to think a little bit around also to Murillo's comment, actually, when it comes to when I go on the intranet and search something around accounting standards, usually the first pages the first two or three pages in Google are usually KPMG, PwC, Deloitte pages. It's not you guys which are coming up there naturally. So I think there is actually a huge challenge to overcome actually to get to you as being the issuer of the standard. And I think that is the key thing actually in order to get kind of a broader acknowledgement what you guys are doing around the globe. And that's, I think, one of the super complicated challenges which you have when it comes to external work.
Yeah. Our last question is on timeliness.
Yeah.
But maybe to cut it off, because we had addressed it this morning, and I think a lot of the comments we made refer to timeliness, which is transparency mm-hmm. of the process. Another thing is, what if in a company someone said that a process is not timely enough, what you usually do is you do a process analysis. You look into the different steps of the process to identify whether there are efficiency gains. And I think an exercise like that, number one, could help the timeliness. And at the same time, if the exercise is done and promoted, it's again a signal that you've taken the topic seriously. So think about whether you shouldn't really engage in such a process analysis, as is common.
We're planning to review the due process handbook next year. It's been 6 years since the last time we reviewed it.
But frankly, I think you need to go a level lower to more into the detail of the different steps of what are the steps done to produce a discussion paper, and after that, that's the level you need to go if you want to find efficiency gain.
And that's the challenge there. I'm selling the pass a bit, but one of the recommendations we had that we should shorten comment periods. Well, we don't intend to do that. We just don't think that's a realistic place for us to be going. So I was very interested in the comments earlier about the fact that we produce a document and then there's a long silence and then we produce another document. Mm. And I think us being more open about what happens during that long silence might help. But actually reducing the process steps,
no, but it wasn't about the comment period. But if you look at the internal processes to develop a draft document, this is a process I think you've got to look at. Is that as efficient as can be, or could that be more efficient? So it's not really the times in which the stakeholders should respond, but rather the time after you received comments until the next thing, the next step is completed. These are the processes. And that's where I really think it needs to go into the detail of the processes, who's involved, who's there, any redundancies and other things in the processes.
Do you have any comment about timeliness?
Just a quick one, because I know this isn't the first time this has been thought about, and the fact that you've introduced research projects is a positive step in that, because when we might think of timeliness, we might be thinking of leases and, you know, those kind of things which have taken a long time because they've been circled around many times. And of course there's positives to that because you've listened, but the downside is the timeliness. So the importance of those research projects is part of that solution, isn't it?
Okay.
Maybe one last one, if you don't mind, on don't trade off timeliness for effectiveness, because we've been talking about simplification and effectiveness, and if you speed up the process, which actually has an inverse impact on understandability and meaningfulness of the financials, then timeliness, I would say, takes a secondary seat to the simplification and understandability tool. So if you were going to prioritize, where do you focus and how do you make it more meaningful and under in perception of the organization, I think timing's actually last. And I think that when you do the first two, you're going to get better timing concurrently. And I think someone else mentioned that earlier. It's part of that, part of every process you have in setting a new standard is keeping that in mind.
Thank you. Well, before move on to next topic, I would like to introduce two people from our side. Yi Li, our technical director.
Thank you. It's my third day on the job today, so I appreciate your giving me a chance to be here. But as you may already know, I've started with the ISB as the executive technical director. I was previously with the SEC staff for about 13 years in the U.S., and then before that I was with PricewaterhouseCoopers for about 8 years, both in London and back in the States. So very interesting conversation. I've been furiously taking notes and have a lot to think about, so thank you for letting me be a part of this.
Thank you. And I would like to introduce one new board member, Tom Scott.
Sorry, all of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.